think of that as the typical worker in the economy. Basically, it excludes professionals. It excludes about the top 15, 20%. It's a little more complex than that. But basically, it excludes those people, and then it takes an average. So the point here is that those workers, non-production, non-supervisory workers, have seen basically flat or declining hourly wages over the last pretty much 30 years. Okay, so they've seen a lot of growth in productivity, but it's either gone to profits, it's gone to high-end workers, or it's gone to paying for higher health care costs, employer-provided health care costs. It hasn't translated into their paycheck. Okay, so that's what I thought I had there, but I just had to double-check that. The second point, I lied on the comparisons of U.S. and Europe. Germany here, I was saying that that was just West Germany. I've been corrected on that. That's all of Germany. Okay, so that includes East Germany. So all of Germany, including East Germany, I can't see it that well, but I'd guess that to be about 93-94% of U.S. productivity. If I just had the number for West Germany, it'd be about 102-103%. So for all their bungling, their welfare state, you know, their stagnation, all the bad things you want to say about them, if you just look at former West Germany, they produce about 3 or 4% more per hour than we do in the United States.
Sorry.
No, that's fine. That's, we're taking questions.
But isn't if productivity is per work hour, not man hour? I mean, the former DDR has really high unemployment, but as long as people who were working were approximately, wouldn't it be reasonable to assume that they would be approximately as productive as people in West Germany?
No, because the question is...
Maybe I'm misunderstanding.
No. It's a really good question. So the question is that in East Germany, for the people who are actually working, East Germany has very high unemployment. It's about 20% unemployment. Much West Germany would be about 7, 7.5 by the U.S. measure. Okay, so East Germany has much higher unemployment, but the question is, but aren't the people who are working as productive as the people in West Germany? And the answer is that they're not, because East Germany still has the legacy of the pre, you know, from this the socialist era. They were working with much more antiquated equipment. Now, to some extent, it's been modernized, but you still have a lot of people working in much older equipment than what you find in the West. So their productivity per worker hour is still much lower than in the West. It's rising. It's risen a lot, but it's still much lower. Yes.
I have so many questions, but I have to tell you that I live in the States. My sister and my father live in Germany, and I was just there for 2 weeks. So this is very interesting to me. My question, I guess I have a couple of questions. Number one, on the comparison, Europe's productivity or on the income chart, so the Europeans have more vacations. Where in the income chart does it show the difference in taxes? How are taxes treated in this whole discussion? I didn't get a sense of that.
Okay, when you think of output, this is, you know, the question is how are taxes treated? So how do we compare the U.S. and Europe? Europe has higher taxes on average than the United States. So how does that fit into the equation here? And it doesn't fit in directly at all. So what we're asking about is what's their total output? What's their output per person? And this is, you know, it doesn't matter directly, at least, we're just saying, you know, what's the total value of the goods and services produced in Europe compared to the United States? That's question one. Now, the way taxes would fit in is indirectly that, you know, I as an economist will go there and go, okay, Europe's really inefficient because, you know, they have really high taxes on labor, they have a really high value-added tax, and therefore their economy is going to be less productive. So, in effect, what we should be able to say, if we want to tell the story about how high taxes are really bad news for economy, their per capita GDP should be much lower than the United States because they have this high tax bill that's pulling down their economy. And my point in trying to make this comparison is, yes, people in Europe do pay much higher taxes than the U.S. They get a lot more services. They have their health care, better education, at least for a lot of people, you know, on down the list. More things they get for those taxes. But it doesn't seem to have much of an effect in terms of pulling down their economy because the main difference between the U.S. and Europe isn't that they're producing less per worker hour, it's simply that they've decided to take more vacation. Okay, so taxes are supposed to be something that affects the economy, but this measure is affected by taxes, but taxes don't directly appear in it.
Well, my follow-on question is on the per capita income. The per capita income, is this before or after taxes? Just a clarification.
That's before taxes.
That's before taxes.
The question is per capita income before or after taxes? We're simply asking the question, what's total output divided by population.
Got it. So when I add up my taxes, my real estate tax, I own a house in New Hampshire, my real estate tax, my DC income tax, my federal income tax, and whatever else I pay, my Social Security tax, and I compare my sister's taxes in Germany, we come out about the same. And I have noticed that one way or another, somehow you end up paying 50-51%, somehow or other, by the time it's all said and done.
Okay.
It's just allocated differently, so I'm curious about that. And I've got this.
Okay, let me just, I don't want to get too much off on this. Okay, the question is that her sister in Germany seems to pay the same in taxes as she does.
And gets way more.
And gets way more. Two points. One is that some of the taxes in Germany may not be as visible at the personal level because a lot, they pay much higher, in effect, sales tax. They have large value-added tax. In most of Europe, they have very large value-added taxes. We have some sales tax, but they're much lower than value-added taxes, which in most European countries are on the order of 15-20%. But secondly, do they get much more? Absolutely. I mean, health care is provided largely by the government in Europe. So most people's health care, not just the senior citizens, but most people's health care is paid for mostly by the government. Not that everything is, but mostly. Education, you have free tuition in college in most countries, or low tuition in the ones that's not free. So you have a lot more government services. Some countries, France, for example, has free child care, universal child care. So there's a lot more services. Part of that is that they're an awful lot more efficient. Their health care costs, the average healthcare costs, the cost of the rest of the industrialized world, is less than half as much on a per-person basis as the U.S., and something I like to point out for everyone who says that, you know, they don't have good services there, they live longer. Okay, so maybe they don't get as many MRIs, CAT scans, whatever, but they do live longer. The other thing, of course, a lot of our taxes go for paying the defense budget. Okay, you know, our defense budget is 4% GDP. The average across Europe is less than 1%. If you throw in prisons, we spend over 1% of our GDP on paying for keeping our prison population, you know, the courts. In Europe, it's trivial. It's like a tenth of a percent. It's nothing. So we're spending a lot of money on things that at least we get no direct benefit from in the sense of improving our consumption. I mean, maybe you want to say those are important things, and that's fine, but, you know, none of us are eating more because we have people in prison. Okay, yes?
The two things and their effect on.
Go ahead.
Okay, all right. Their effect on GDP. Medicare and Medicaid seem are like direct payments into the healthcare industry. Seems like not transfer payments. Are they included in GDP? And second, the interest that we pay on the national debt. And I'm going back to 1, 2, 3, slide 4, shares of GDP, and I'm wondering whether or not the increasing interest on the national debt is, how that is affects or is calculated in debt GDP.
Okay, so the question is, do Medicare and Medicaid payments count in GDP, and then secondly, do interest payments count in GDP? And the answer is neither counts directly. Okay, because neither is a direct payment for good service. Medicare and Medicaid, for the most part, are paid to individuals, to healthcare providers. The way that would be treated is they'd be counted as consumption. It's somewhat arbitrary. So if I went to a government hospital, if I went to a VA hospital, that's a government service. That counts as government. But if I'm on Medicare and Medicaid, not 100%, because sometimes those will be through government clinics, but if I go to a private clinic, what they would do is count that as private consumption, even though the government's paying the bill. So it's a little trivial in the distinction there, but that would count as, be treated as consumption, not as government spending. Now, interest on the debt, there's no good or service that directly corresponds to that. So I'm a bondholder, I own, you know, $1 million in government bonds, give me $100,000 interest. That $100,000 doesn't count in GDP. I go out and spend it, you know, I buy a new car or something, that counts in GDP. Okay, but that payment, that interest payment, is not going to count. Okay, the woman.
So I have two questions, and they both relate to the government spending issue, because I'm a little conundrum about that. One, how do these standard models deal with the fact that government spending, on the one hand, is counted as part of GDP, so therefore, presumably, the more you're spending, you know, the higher your GDP, therefore more growth. But on the other hand, you're saying that government spending always invariably leads in these economic models to less jobs, therefore less growth. I'm just wondering how in the standard models they deal with that.
Okay.
Apparent tension.
Yeah, no, that's a really good question. So the question is that, at least at first blush, if the government were to spend an additional $100 billion on education, defense, whatever it might be, that looks like it's increasing GDP, so why does that end up decreasing GDP? And this has to do with the distinction between long run and short run. So in the short run, the standard models will allow that sometimes we could be in a downturn, you know, be hard to say, you know, in 2001 we weren't in a downturn, the unemployment rate got up to 6.5, I forget how high it went, but, you know, clearly there were people unemployed, so we're in an economic downturn, and there, if we increase government spending, even in the standard models, that would show at least, you know, for 6 months or a year, that would lead to more GDP, more growth. Now, their argument, these models are basically long-term models. So the argument is over the long term, what does that mean? Okay, we've increased $100 billion in spending. What the models are going to say is, okay, you must have increased someone's taxes. And I'm George W. Bush, so I never increased anyone's taxes. I go, no, we didn't do that. Now, if I increase someone's taxes, then I've reduced your take-home pay, so you would have been willing to work, but now you're paying a higher tax bill, so you don't work, so less jobs. But the other side of it is that, suppose I'm George W. Bush, I never raised taxes, what will go on in the standard models is, okay, you didn't raise taxes, instead what happened is you have higher interest rates. Now, because you have higher interest rates, there's less investment, less home buying, so that's going to cost jobs. Okay, so the issue is, over the long run, that increased spending will cost jobs in the economy, even though, let's say, we're in an economic downturn, it's possible, at least in the short term, that could increase employment.
And I have a follow-up question, which is, okay, so I understand the idea that we can use their models, just throw their models back in their face, you know, with the Fed spending or whatever, and then also sometimes we want to say, yeah, we agree with your model, we still think it's worth it. I guess my question to you is, you know, do we have alternate models? What parts, if any, of their models do we accept? And, you know, is there an alternate model that says, you know, government spending equals jobs equals more growth? Because that's, you know, that's a position we're all going to be in.
Okay.
When we have
okay, so the question is, you know, yes, we could throw their models in the face and go, you know, yeah, your defense spending costs jobs, but the question is, are there alternative models that we could throw out there? Are they credible? And what would they say about increasing government spending? The answer, there's not a good, simple answer to that. Let me give you how I see it, and many, many other people would disagree, but having worked on policy here for a little shy of 15 years, my approach is, it's very hard to move from the mainstream in economics. They're very powerful, they have lots of credentials, and yes, I can come up with an alternative model. And the question is, why should anyone listen to me? And, you know, my frustration being in policy debates is that, you know, people are much more swayed by credentials than by arguments. And, you know, just to give something really simple, and I think I talked about this last week, and maybe I'll talk about it every time I talk, but, you know, in the Social Security debate, one of the things that I tried to argue about was stock returns. And the whole issue about what returns you can get with stock was nothing more than the arithmetic we all learned in third grade. And it took me years to finally win that debate, and I only won it because I got Paul Krugman to agree with me and write about it in the New York Times, because if I didn't get that, we'd still be losing the argument. So what matters is credentials. So yes, you know, I could produce an alternative model, and no one is going to give a damn. So that's why, you know, to my mind, it's not worth it. Now, just very, very briefly, what I would say, and, you know, what I think of their models versus an alternative, their models assume that the economy is basically at full employment. I would say we're almost never at full employment. I'd say, you know, the short-term story that I was saying a moment ago, that, you know, yeah, we could spend more money and that will create jobs, I would say that's almost always true. Not to say that, you know, never is that the case, that we can't spend more money and produce jobs. In World War II, we were at full employment. You know, maybe we were at full employment briefly in 2000, maybe in the late 1960s when the unemployment rate was 3%. You know, maybe, but those are really the exceptions. So rather than being the general rule that we're at full employment, I think those are very rare exceptions. But again, I sort of have a sense, here's where you can have some impact. You know, going over there trying to get someone to accept my alternative model, not anytime soon. Yes?
On the charts, for anytime you refer to output and it's, productivity and it's output per hour, is the output part of that just GDP?
GDP, yeah.
Okay, so the most.
Oh, so the question is, with productivity, the numerator, we're saying output per hour of work is at GDP, and yes, that's what's in there. Yes, sir.
Why doesn't raising the minimum wage look good then in these standard models that you described?
Okay, the question is, why doesn't raising the minimum wage look good in the standard models? Well, raising the minimum wage is going to be a distortion in the labor market. So what would happen there is that we have some workers that, you know, we have $5.25 an hour minimum wage, supposedly raised it to $5.50, there are some people that were willing to work for $5.25 an hour, they're not going to be working. The economy is going to be less efficient because of that. So that would imply that, you know, you both have a direct loss of jobs, you know, because the person is willing to work for $5.25 an hour is out of work.
So don't you mean that the company's not going to employ someone at $5.50?
Okay, they kind of,
that's
right.
That people, there were all these people who were staying home and watching TV unless they could get $5.50 an hour. If you guarantee them $5.50, now they'll come and work and the economy ought to be better off.
Okay, so the question is that people are now getting a higher wage, so shouldn't they
so
be
they
happy to work?
Away, they move away from their TV and are willing to work.
Okay.
I'm alluding to your...
No, I understand, So the question is, since people were opting to watch the television at $5.25 an hour, aren't they better off, aren't more people going to work when we've raised the minimum wage to $5.50 an hour? Yeah, that's a good question. Now, what they would say, the standard argument would be, is, well, they actually aren't that productive. Otherwise, they already would have been able to get $5.50 an hour. So what the government is saying is, you know, there's people that they're able to produce $5.30 an hour, $5.35 an hour. They're saying, you can't work. You know, we're putting a floor. It's not legal to hire someone who is, you know, their productivity is less than $5.50 an hour. So the firm isn't willing to hire them at $5.50 an hour. They'd be willing to hire them at $5.35, but not $5.50. So therefore, you have fewer people working. So it's made the economy less efficient. Now let me also add, this is one of the most extensively researched topics in economics, and what the data actually finds is there's very little evidence that raising the minimum wage leads to job loss. Now that's not to say you couldn't raise it, you know, $2 an hour and get some job loss, but, you know, we've had minimum wage increases in the last decade, and, you know, people look back at the earlier ones, there's been a lot of research on that, and the vast majority finds little or no job loss. So when you actually try and look in the world and you go, okay, you know, it was $4.15 an hour before the last raised it to $5.25 over 2 years. That was what, 96, 97. There's very little evidence of job loss associated with that. And people have looked really, really hard. They've looked at, you know, where you'd expect to see it among young workers, teenagers, whatever it might be. There's very, very little evidence. But in sort of the basic model, it should lead to job loss.
And what is the reason for that, do you think?
The question is, what's the reason that it hasn't led to job loss? I say that I think employment is pretty unresponsive to modest changes in wages. So the number of employers, you know, think of what we're talking about, minimum wage jobs. You're talking about a cashier. You're talking about someone working at McDonald's, a fast food restaurant. Whether you pay the person at the counter, you know, $5 an hour or $4.15 an hour, it's not going to determine how many people you need to run the restaurant, and only in very, very rare occasions, again, determine whether it's profitable to have the restaurant or not. So basically, there's very little sensitivity. Now, if you had to twist my arm, you go, okay, we just raised the minimum wage by 20%. Is employment of teenagers going to go up or down? I'd probably say it will go down, but a really, really tiny amount. And, you know, again, getting back to how we think about these things, suppose I told you that's going to reduce employment among teenagers by 1%. You know, you have a lot of people run around. I've been engaged in debates with them, you know, from places like the Cato Institute. They go, well, that's going to cost, you know, 1% of jobs. You know, if we're talking about a group that's, let's say, 10 million people, that's going to cost 100,000 jobs. All right, well, we've just raised our pay by 20%. And as a practical matter, what are these jobs? They're rapid turnover jobs. I mean, people aren't expecting to spend their life at McDonald's. So what does that literally mean? It means it's a little harder, you know, when someone quits their job or they get fired, whatever, and they go out and look for a new job, it takes them a little longer to find it. But once they find it, they get paid 20% more. So do we think that's a bad thing? I'm hard-pressed. So what? So what? You know, now if you told me it led to a 15% decline in employment, well, yeah, that might be a real issue. But, you know, there's absolutely no evidence to support anything like that. So maybe the evidence is such that you could say if we raise the minimum wage by 15 or 20%, we're going to see a 1%, maybe a 2% decline in employment if you want to be generous. But everyone who's got a job for the period they're working are getting 20% more. To me, that sounds like a pretty good deal. Yes?
I have two questions. How can we distinguish consumption from investment? Like, for me, like a college tuition shown as consumption here, it could be investment in the future. So investment is the investment by private sector, I mean the enterprises here, or this is the first question. The second question is, and since I'm working on development, I'm interested in how I can apply these standards of the models to developing countries. And is this like, are these models only for OECD countries, or can we apply, or I mean, just, I just Okay. We have different kinds of models to unknown OECD countries, so this is very
Okay, let me take the second question first. The second question is this discussion GDP just applied to OECD countries, or does it apply to developing countries as well? The answer to that is, in principle, it applies across the board. We use the same accounting. Now, accounting becomes much, much harder in developing countries, both because, just as a practical matter, it's, you know, in sub-Saharan Africa, we don't have very good censuses. We can't go out and monitor very much how much is being produced. But also, you have a much bigger issue of household production. You know, here it's, you know, to some extent the exception. I could talk about someone raising their kid at home, you know, and, you know, preparing meals at home. It's an exception. A lot of poor countries, you still have a very large amount of subsistence agriculture. People are growing their own food. They make their own clothes. So GDP accounting is much, much harder.
I mean, the standard models here, not the
GDP. Oh, the models, yes. The models. So the question, would the same models apply? Yes. So if I was being a neoclassical economist and we're talking about, you know, in the Republic of Congo, you know, if we imposed the minimum wage, yes, that would have bad results. You know, there's some exceptions to this, but as a general rule, you know, the models will show you any government intervention in the economy leads to reductions in output. The second point, consumption and investment, there's lots of things that, you know, will get counted in GDP as consumption that we could think of as an investment. Certainly education is the most obvious. So there's a category of consumption, you know, college tuition payments, that obviously is an investment in the sense that, you know, most people think will increase their earnings capacity. I mean, you go to college for other reasons as well, but, you know, part of the story, of course, people expect that if you get a college degree, you're going to get higher wages in your life than if you just had a high school education. But that, you know, as a matter of accounting, it counts as consumption. Flip that over, I mean, you can look at a lot of investment, a lot of things that firms do that count as investment that, you know, might be very questionable, you know, some software they get, whatever. I mean, I won't go into detail on that, but it really is just a bookkeeping standard. So it's not as though everything that people spend on consumption is, you know, burnt up tomorrow or something. You know, some of it has lasting benefits, you know, for themselves, for the economy. Yes, there's a woman back here. You.
So talk about the minimum wage example where what the model said is different from the data, in real life. How come these, you know, modeling companies are still in business if their predictions don't come true? Or do they come true sometimes and not others? How do we know?
So the question is, if you have, you know, sort of a real-world phenomena that, you know, we've raised the minimum wage and produces almost no unemployment, then why would, you know, how come the modeling of it doesn't take that into account? And if they don't take that into account, how they can continue to exist? Well, a couple things. One is that, I'll be generous to them, I suspect a lot of the modelers have taken it into account in the sense that they've reduced, you know, over the years, they've reduced the impact that they would project from an increase in the minimum wage. My guess, and I don't know this, I haven't gone to all of them, so I can't say this for certain, but my guess is that probably all of the major models, econometric models, which show that an increase in the minimum wage will lead to some increase in unemployment, but they probably have adjusted their models so that the increase would be much less than it would have been, you know, before we had this research. You know, but say if you went back 15, 20 years when there wasn't this large body of research showing the minimal impact. But it is sort of a basic principle of the model that this should show some reduction in employment. And, you know, it's sort of like you have your model that everyone deeply believes, or all these economists deeply believe, and then you have the real world that stubbornly is resisting it. So I think what they end up doing is compromising. You know, so I think most of those people really do believe it. But the other thing is, you know, these are political, they work for hire. And I don't mean to say they're all corrupt. Some of them might be, but I may have mentioned this last time. You know, there's still a debate over drilling in the Arctic Wildlife Refuge, but in 2000, 2001, one of the big arguments for allowing oil drilling in the Arctic Wildlife Refuge was that it would create 500,000, 750,000 jobs. And that was based on a study that came out of the WEFA, which was, it merged with another firm. It's now Global Insights. It's one of the biggest, if not the biggest, econometric forecasting firm in the country. And that was a totally bogus model. And, you know, they were pushing this, and it was getting in the Times and the Post, and being cited in NPR, was getting all over the place. They're using it. And we looked at it, and it was just, there was no way, I mean, they could not honestly say that with their own model. And we challenged them on it, and they backed down. They said, we can't support those numbers. So that was, they were paid by the oil industry to do that study, and I don't know if someone just really goofed, or obviously, you know, they had a real interest in producing a real big number. So I don't know.
I have a personal direct line on the NAFTA predictions, because I know the person who was involved in making them, and Gary Huffbauer, and he said that his boss took their work and eliminated mention of all the caveats and the qualifications and just mentioned the 150,000 job increase figure. And, of course, it turned out not to be true. We didn't get that increase in jobs. So it was partly, the model was partly wrong, but it was not as wrong as the press made it appear, because the actual study was not fully presented to the press.
The point, I'll just quickly say a comment on that. There was a famous study in 92 that came out about NAFTA that said it would create 150,000, 200,000 jobs. The Clinton administration touted it was in the economic report of the president, and they highlighted it everywhere. And the author of the study, Gary Huffbauer, has since said, you know, no, that wasn't, it's misinterpreted this and that. And apparently he had included a lot of caveats. I still don't know how I got 150,000, 200,000. But in any case, even if he had done an honest kosher model, I mean, the standard neoclassical models probably would have showed a job gain of about 20,000. It'd been a very, I mean, obviously we'd all like to see 20,000 jobs, but, you know, in the scheme of things, that's, you know, that's about what the economy makes, creates ordinarily in about, you know, one day. Are there questions from people that haven't asked one yet? Yes. Well, you asked one. You didn't ask one yet.
Yeah. I guess I'm not totally satisfied yet with the answer to the question about applying these models to developing countries. I know that they do and will, but I also increasingly feel they shouldn't for a whole bunch of reasons, and I'd like to hear you, from your perspective, what your opinion on what those reasons might be, where the state of debate is.
Okay.
And the second one is just about issues of inequality and the distribution of income and wealth and its impact on growth. Where's the state of the art on that?
Okay, starting with the first one, the question is, you know, what's the status of applying these models to developing countries? It is done all the time. The IMF and World Bank, you know, you've all heard about the Washington Consensus, the neoliberal agenda. It used to be the case, if you go back 30 years ago, 40 years ago, there was a major area of economics, or at least a major important area of economics called development economics. That basically has disappeared. The idea of development economics was that developing countries were qualitatively different from rich countries, that they didn't have well-developed markets, transportation systems, so that a lot of things that we might want to say about the rich countries may not apply in developing countries. So it was felt to be important to treat, you know, the economies of developing countries as being very different. That basically got destroyed over the last 20 or so years, 25 years, where, you know, the sort of conventional wisdom is, no, the developing countries are basically just like the rich countries, or at least we should analyze them the same way, and just, you know, what's good in the rich countries is also good in the developing countries. Now, if you talk to the people at the IMF and World Bank, they're all in town this week, they would say, oh, no, 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 no one believes that. But then if you look at what they recommend for the countries, it sure looks like they believe it, or at least they're suggesting that. So what do I think? I think, no. I mean, these countries are not like the U.S. They have all sorts of problems. I don't think their models work very well in the U.S. I think they work horribly in Latin America, in, you know, in Sub-Saharan Africa, in East Asia. And, I mean, you should come next week or 2 weeks from now, because you'll hear more on that. We have a session on that. But just, you know, just the simple track record. We have a new paper up on our website that talks about the track record and development of the last quarter century, and it's been abysmal. And the big exceptions, they're very important exceptions, India and China, that people beat up on us. That's half the developing world. Of course they are. But those are not neoclassical models. They did not do what the IMF and World Bank would tell the countries in Latin America to do. And that's probably because they're big enough that they weren't able to tell them what to do. So they've had very strong growth in those countries and not followed, you know, sort of the neoliberal model. Now, the second question, what's the state of the art on issues of inequality and growth? I don't think there's any real consensus on it. I mean, it's really, you know, the people who control the discipline are really pushing policies that increase inequality, have the effect of increasing inequality, not because that's what they say they're trying to do, although I have actually encountered some economists who say quite literally that is what they're trying to do, but that's not in general what they'll say. but they'll say we're trying to remove imperfections in the labor market. You know, we want to weaken unions. We want to weaken government regulation that, you know, give workers 6 weeks vacation. We shouldn't do that. You know, we shouldn't have a 35-hour work week. These are measures that will lead to higher inequality, but they'll say that that will increase economic output. Now, the evidence on it, which some, if we got one of those people in the room and go, what's your evidence to back this up? 90% of the time they'll back down and say, well, no, that's not the evidence. You know, and they'll always act like they, you know, have over there some evidence that they can point to, and we keep trying to find where over there is. So, you know, if you really had a serious discussion with someone, you say, well, what really is the evidence on inequality and growth? I don't think anyone could point to a body of evidence that says, if we have more inequality, we have growth. We have more growth. The evidence that we've seen, you know, that I've seen other people I work with, you know, it's very limited, very weak. And, you know, sort of the simple story, you have a lot of countries that have a lot more equality than the United States. Just about everyone has more equality than the United States among the developed countries. And they have very comparable output per worker hour. Now, again, they may have lower per capita GDP, but if someone wants to tell me, you know, oh, that's really horrible, they work less, well, that's fine if you don't like it, but they seem to like it, and that's your problem, not theirs.
According to this standard neoclassical model, are there ways to make arguments that environmental protection is not going to come at the expense of growth? And secondly, I think all of us are having a lot of trouble with the standard model. And I was wondering if you could just go a little bit into the history of how the neoclassical economists managed to basically take over the universities. My recollection is back in 1978, there was a major purge at Harvard where all of the progressive economists were booted out and ended up at UMass Amherst. I was up in Massachusetts at the time. Did this take place across the country? Was there some kind of a Stalinist purge that took place?
Okay, let me take the second part of that first. The question, I'll take one more question after this. Second part of the question is, how did neoclassical economics take over the profession? You know, was there a purge? You know, how did they chase out all the non-neoclassicals? There's not a simple answer to it, but I'd say it was something like a purge. You know, basically, who controls economics departments, who controls university, who controls money? When you get a university increasingly oriented towards bringing in money, you know, faculty are increasingly expected to bring in a portion of their salary, a large portion of their salary. You know, you bring in more, the better. You can hire research assistants, you can publish more. Well, if you have contributors that are willing to, you know, contribute to you because you're doing research that promotes a conservative, a business agenda, well, you're better situated. And you've had some, you know, to some extent, I don't want to be conspiratorial about it, but you have some people like Martin Feldstein, I'll single out my hero here, who was, you know, on Reagan's Council of Economic Advisors, he's a professor at Harvard, he's the head of the National Bureau of Economic Research, and he's mentioned always as one of the top candidates to be a successor, Alan Greenspan. He is a very smart, very aggressive person in pushing a conservative agenda. So, you know, he's tried, you know, National Bureau of Economic Research, very prestigious institution. I'm willing to bet that it's much easier to become a fellow at the National Bureau of Economic Research if you're pushing conservative economics. If you push, you know, something that's not orthodox, you're going to have one hell of a time, probably altogether impossible. You know, so they have been aggressive in taking control of the department, and I have departments, economic departments. And, you know, in my own case, I and Mark Weisbrot, we both went to Michigan, University of Michigan in the 80s. And, you know, obviously we were not orthodox economists. We couldn't go there and get a dissertation through there, you know, unless we were prepared to do mainstream stuff, which maybe we do, you know, and we'd be good boys for, you know, 5 years or whatever. But, you know, but you would not get through there with an unorthodox dissertation today. So they really have, you know, sort of solidified their control of the discipline. They have the money. They've been able to solidify control. I mean, the whole story is much more complex than that, but, you know, but that has been what's going on. The first question you'd ask is, you know, is there a way to talk about environmental protection actually increasing employment or not costing employment? And let me give you two ways that you could talk about that, one of which would be all but impossible to get neoclassical economists to accept. The other one you might get some to grudgingly accept. The first one is that firms could be dumb, that there could be opportunities to increase efficiency that firms are not taking advantage of. And some people have done research and found that there's all these ways that are actually money saving and allow firms to, you know, burn less energy, use less energy, and actually save them money. So, in other words, they're just stupid. You know, you had, you know, you could use more fuel efficient light bulbs, you know, energy efficient light bulbs, you know, and other things you could do that would both reduce energy consumption and also save the firm money. They would be paid back. You know, so they have to buy the new, more expensive light bulb, but they would be paid back in their energy saving over 3 or 4 years. You know, so even if you did your interest accounting right, you know, they'd still come out better. I actually think there's probably a lot of cases like that, but to get economists to accept that, you know, the argument they always say, you know, that's finding a $100 bill on the street. You know, why wouldn't they have done it? So, you know, trying to get an economist to believe that, you almost have to, like, drag them there and go, here's this firm. It's right here. They could have done it. They didn't do it. It's right there. You know, they go, okay, well, there's that one, but there's no others like it. No. So that's one way. The other way that... If you want to say there's a good side to the hurricanes, that, you know, maybe you could twist their arms and get them to accept. Obviously, these hurricanes are causing, you know, apart from killing people, they're causing enormous, you know, we're talking about a $200 billion bill that the government's going to pay for Katrina, and now we have another one that who knows how much damage it'll do. Now, we have a lot of climate experts who say that the probability, not necessarily those specific hurricanes, but the probability of a hurricane is vastly increased because of global warming. So if you could say, okay, the probability of, you know, severe climatic events, hurricanes, tornadoes, other events that have real costs, dollar and cents costs, that that's increased. We're all going to pay for that in higher insurance because none of this is free. Okay, or higher tax bills if the government picks up the tab. That there are real dollars and cents costs associated with not doing anything with global warming, allowing global warming to happen, then you could perhaps make the case. And I actually think probably the science supports that. You know, in the sense that, you know, I'm not an expert on global warming, but I know people are. I think the science probably supports that. We've actually tried to do a project with an economist in the Northwest, looking specifically at the Northwest, what we do to their economy. And I think that would be a way that, at least in principle, you know, you can get an economist to accept that, you know, maybe if we, you know, got more fuel-efficient cars, drove less, whatever, that might actually be better off because we wouldn't have to spend so much cleaning up the damage from all these hurricanes. Okay, one more question. If there's anyone who didn't ask one. You asked one, right? Go ahead.
Can I ask it?
Yeah.
Great. I'm really, really interested in job creation, and I work in international development. And my question to you is, looking at the sources of GDP, are there inherently better sources of sustainable job creation in the four different choices, consumption, investment? I know government's out. But let's say the three exports, at the face of it, seems the best.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about that? I mean, these are not all equally good, these jobs.
Right. Okay, so the question is there a type of GDP that's better in terms of creating long-term sustainable jobs? It's sort of the first blush. I mean, what's easy to say is that, you know, if we spend more on investment, we spend more on exports, we're sort of getting something for the future. So in that sense, we might think in general, you know, that it's better that our GDP is devoted for investment so that, you know, in the future we'll be better off. Or you could talk about for exports that in the future we'll be accumulating wealth. Basically, we'd be selling. The idea is that we'd be building up assets in the form of debt or, you know, financial assets that other countries would have to pay us back in the future. You could also say it, and you could probably even get most neoclassical economists to accept this, however grudgingly, that, you know, government spending in the form of either building up infrastructure or education, you know, they will acknowledge that education can be productive, you know, that if it's well-directed can also make us better off in the future. So something that has the character of making us better off in the future. Now, let me jump a little bit on this to something that, you know, really is just remarkable. It disappeared. Used to be the case that sort of the conventional wisdom was that a rich country like the United States should run a trade surplus, that we should, in effect, we should be exporting more than we're importing because we're rich. So we're producing goods, and then you have the poorer countries in Latin America, you know, South Asia, Sub-Saharan Africa, that they're importing more than they're exporting. They're borrowing in order to finance their development. Now, that's been turned on its head a little bit in the 80s and hugely in the last decade, where we're now in the situation where we're importing way more than we're exporting. Now, the nice story that economists would like to have told in prior decades, or did tell, I should say, they can't tell it now because it's not true, clearly. But the nice story they would like to tell is that this is good on both sides. We're exporting to developing countries so that their people could still eat as they build up their infrastructure, you know, because they can't do both. They're very poor, so they have a choice to either eat or to build their infrastructure. Well, if they had the opportunity to import from the United States, they could import the food for so everyone could eat while they go out and build their infrastructure. You can't tell that now. And the other part of the story that will benefit us is, okay, we're exporting a lot to them now. We're all getting older. So at some point in the future, when, you know, when all these countries are developed, we're all going to be older and we're going to be retired, but we're all going to have accumulated all these assets in, you know, sub-Saharan Africa. You know, we own factories and land or government bonds, whatever it might be, from, you know, Latin America and sub-Saharan Africa. Now, these are wealthy countries, so they'll be paying back our interest, you know, paying us interest on that debt, and, you know, we have a happy old age. So that's the story that they used to like to tell. You can't tell that when we're borrowing $700 billion a year from the rest of the world, including a lot of it coming from places like Latin America and China, poor countries. But that used to be how we talked about it.
This trade deficit, if you took oil out of it, what would that do to it?
The question is, how would it, the trade deficit be affected by oil? It would be about $100 billion lower. Still a very large trade deficit. Okay, I better stop there. Going over time. Come back next week.
Thank you for doing this. Great.
There's a lot of people in D.C. who are working on issues where economists are called on, and they're not familiar with even the most basic concepts. And, you know, what I'm saying is literally what we see. You know, we see, you know, they hire.